Welcome to SNI Digital Innovations in Learning in association with UCLA Neurosurgery. Linda Liao, Chairwoman, and its faculty are pleased to bring you the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery 101 Lecture Series on Neurosurgery and Clinical and Basic Neuroscience. This series of lectures are provided free to bring the advances in clinical and basic neuroscience to physicians and patients everywhere. One out of every five people in the world suffer from a neurologically related disease. The lecture and discussion is on the methods to identify the epileptogenic zone, stereo EEG versus subdural evaluation. The lecturer is Arya Fala, Assistant Professor of Neurosurgery, Pediatrics, and Health Policy and Management from the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, Los Angeles, California, United States of America.
Which is basically a non-invasive evaluation. That's the MRI, the PET scan, neuropsychology testing, EEG, history physical, important parts of the epilepsy evaluation. Phase two is the invasive EEG portion. So not every patient will get this. So sometimes we say this patient's a skip candidate, meaning we skip phase two and go straight to phase three. The phase three is actually the definitive procedure. But as you'll see, and we'll discuss, that not every patient is appropriate to skip phase two on. And sometimes we need to do that invasive EEG evaluation. So any sort of implant is considered phase two. So have no financial interest, no disclosures. So if you look at the epilepsy evaluation, you see that on the left side, going from non-invasive to invasive and intraoperative studies, and each one of these tests tells you part of the picture. So the important thing with an epilepsy evaluation is that you cannot look at any one modality in its entirety. You cannot just look at an MRI, say there's a lesion, so that's causing the epilepsy, and I'm just going to go after that. Or just look at semiology or PET scan. So you got to really look at all of this information together. And each hospital has a different workup strategy. So for us here at UCLA, you may know that FDG PET for use in epilepsy was first developed here by Harry Chagani many years ago. It was popularized and it's now being used many places. So that the MRI, 3T MRI, PET scan, video EEG, and the neuropsych testing for patients the age of six and above is part of our standard workup. And really, this is what you want to get at. So these are the main concepts in epilepsy surgery. You may have a structural lesion. There may be a larger irritative zone. So this is the zone where on ECOG, you may find, you know, spikes, epileptiform discharges. There's a seizure onset zone, and there's an ictal network. So there's different strategies for removing the epileptogenic zone. Keep in mind, the epileptogenic zone is a theoretical area. We cannot image it. The only way you know you fully removed the epileptogenic zone is that the patient seizure-free many years later. So it's unlike, you know, a tumor surgery where you can come out and tell the patient, I got it all. You can't do that in epilepsy surgery. You have to really wait to see if you got it all. So the strategies here, and you can look at, this is sort of superimposed, what each one of these tests tell you. And, you know, there's ongoing investigation whether, you know, HFO, for example, I'm not going to talk about much, but this is sort of a newer biomarker for the zone that generates epilepsy, high frequency oscillation. Again, discovered here at UCLA many years ago. And now there's clinical trials looking at the importance of resecting HFO areas in achieving seizure freedom. So what are the indications for invasive EEG or phase two? When you don't have an MRI lesion. So sometimes you hear the word, we throw around the words, this is a non-lesional case. What that means is that the MRI is normal. doesn't mean that there's no underlying lesion. It's usually what we're looking for is a very subtle cortical dysplasia, but we use that term a lot, non-lesional. Or in other cases of multiple lesions. So tuberous sclerosis being a perfect example where you have multiple lesions and you don't really know which one is causing the epilepsy. If your non-invasive data is inconclusive, or you have divergent non-invasive data where not everything agrees or points to the same region, you may want to do an invasive evaluation. Other reason to do it is if you want to map eloquent cortical function precisely, motor, speech, sensory, or secondary indications are to further corroborate the epileptogenic zone. So you may have an idea where the seizures are coming from, in what general area. You may know right frontal lobe, for example, or right parietal lobe, but you want to know with a lot more accuracy where exactly. So that's another reason to sometimes place a grid. You want to map out eloquent function, and that also allows you to prognosticate for a patient. It's very different, you know, with epilepsy surgery, there's no guarantee. So it's difficult to consent a patient and say, look, we're going to do the surgery. It's likely you're going to be seizure-free. It's likely you're going to wake up with a deficit, or you may or may not wake up with a deficit. It's a hard thing for some patients to agree to. So for some specific situations, you may want to place invasive EEG just to better delineate the borders of your resection and better inform the patient of their expected outcome. So in terms of decision-making, you want to make sure first of all, you need to have a reasonable hypothesis. Without a hypothesis, placing electrodes in the brain is not going to yield any useful information. You want to look at that divergent or inconclusive non-invasive data and see if it can be explained by a known limitation of the EEG and functional imaging data. For example, sometimes if you have a epileptogenic foci deep in the brain, let's say in the interhemispheric region, you may get falsely lateralizing EEG. Keep in mind the surface EEG electrodes are far away from the interhemispheric area. So even though they do a better job recording from the cortical surface, if you have a deep lesion or an insular lesion or a cingulate gyrus lesion, orbital frontal, you're not going to capture it necessarily directly on the electrodes that are over closest to that area. You want to look at whether there's other non-invasive tests that could be done to eliminate the need for invasive EEG. So these are other specialized tests, SPECT scan, MEG scan, a whole host of other tests that can sometimes be done to avoid intracranial EEG. You want to make sure that the added information from the invasive EEG will be likely to change the operative plan. And you also want to make sure that that added information that you're looking to get cannot be achieved with just intraoperative ECOG. That's electrocorticography, that's direct recordings from the brain. Usually it's intraictal data. It's very rare to actually record seizures during surgery. You also want to look at the medical comorbidities that may contraindicate invasive EEG. And then there's a few modalities of invasive EEG, which we'll talk about. So why phase two evaluation? It gives you a higher signal to noise ratio. The electrodes on the surface of the brain require a large enough discharge from the surface of the brain for that to travel through the dura, the skull, the scalp, and finally be picked up by an electrode on the surface of the scalp. But when you go invasive, you really eliminate all of that. So there's no muscle artifact, higher spatial resolution, and you may see a seizure pattern before the surface EEG. What are the contraindications to invasive monitoring? Psychiatric illness. So for patients that are at risk for psychosis or schizophrenia or depression, you want to be careful because they don't do too well with the invasive evaluation. Age less than 2 years used to be a contraindication, but we've sort of pushed the limit, and I'll show you how we do that, how we can do these operations in infants. And also, if you don't have an adequate hypothesis, again, if you don't have this, you're unlikely to be successful. So invasive monitoring has been around for a long time. Fedor Kraus, you see Wilder Penfield. A lot of what we know about the brain is actually from the field of epilepsy, knowing what the functions of the brain are, what different parts do. And there's a huge and fascinating, there's a long history that's quite fascinating about epilepsy. I actually encourage you all to read it. There were procedures being done, trepanations and all that for epilepsy. And that history is actually quite interesting. But a lot of what we know is through this. And this has been around for a very long time. Our techniques have changed, but we've been interested in monitoring the brain for a very long time. So some special considerations for phase two evaluation. So this is a non-lesional MRI. Again, there's no particular lesion that you can identify, but if you have a reasonable hypothesis that the seizures are coming from a focal or at least lateralized area, you may want to implant electrodes here. The other consideration is focal cortical dysplasia. This is the patient with a left insular dysplasia here that spans into the frontal operculum. The challenge with cortical dysplasia, which is the most common etiology that we treat in the pediatric side, is that it's difficult to know the full extent of the lesion. So what you may be seeing is the tip of the iceberg. And it is a mistake to just go and resect what you see on MRI, because quite often the area around it could also be dysplastic. So in these situations, invasive EEG could be helpful. And the other case, this is the most common case of genetic epilepsy in children, tuberous sclerosis complex. Children are born with multiple tubers in the brain, often refractory to anti-epileptic medication. And one of the greatest challenges with tuberous sclerosis surgery is identifying the epileptogenic tuber or tubers. So this is another situation that may benefit from it. So a lot of what we do in epilepsy surgery, we spend a lot of time with the neurologist, and you really work hand in hand. So as the one unique thing about this field is, as an epilepsy surgeon, you got to try to learn epilepsy as much as you can from the neurologist, and they got to try to learn surgery as much as they can. Because if you don't understand the other person, you're not going to be very successful, because your success is you're only as good as your weakest link when it comes to epilepsy surgery, whether that's surgery, the surgeon, neurologist, radiologist, and so on. So an important part of dissecting a seizure semiology, which is really the play-by-play of a seizure, right? What is the first symptom? What is the second symptom? What is the first sign that we see? And you really, based on what you see, you can pinpoint where the seizures may be coming from, usually to one or two regions of the brain with different degrees of reliability. So, you know, some of this you may know, but I would encourage, and I can share these slides to take a look at, and if you're interested in it, you can sort of you know, for example, ictal fear is usually related to an amygdalar lesion with a high degree of reliability. Nose wiping is a sign of insular seizures. Or if you have a choking sensation, that's a sign of insular seizure. So these are, it's really fascinating. I encourage you to read it. And then also with the seizure itself, you want to look at the different phases of the seizure. The preictal phase, the prodrome, and the aura can tell you things about a seizure, the ictal onset. You know, if, for example, a patient has aphasia during a seizure, you know that it's their dominant hemisphere. And, you know, the postictal phase, for example, a patient with a Todd's paresis, so a weakness in one half of the body, you can usually infer the seizures coming from the contralateral hemispheric region. I will say in pediatric epilepsy, it's much, much more challenging because the seizure semiologies are actually quite bland. And, you know, obviously they don't report any auras. So you're looking at, you know, sometimes something like infantile spasms, which is a very short, brief, generalized looking seizure, but could be coming from a very focal area. And that's why the pediatric EEGs are a little bit more challenging to read and try to identify where the seizures are originating from. So rules for implantation strategy. So you have this discussion as a group. This is what you want to target when you implant electrodes. You want to go after the cortex involved in the seizure onset as well as the early propagation. You want to cover your alternative hypothesis. You want to delineate a border of the epileptogenic zone. So it's not enough to say it's anterior cingulate gyrus. You may want to know how far back on the anterior cingulate gyrus or how far forward. And you can use stereo EEG or electrodes implanted to try to delineate that border. As a surgeon, you need to know where to cut and where to stop. And quite often the neurologists don't give you that information, right? It's sort of based on what you they'll tell you that it's this general location, and you would have to try to figure that out with your EEG implantation strategy. You want to cover nearby eloquent area. And of course, if there's any underlying lesions. What do you do after a phase two evaluation? You really want to minimize the amount of days with implanted electrodes. This is why when you see me do these cases, I always implant on a Monday and I try to explant on a Friday. I don't like to leave a patient with electrodes in their brain over the weekend where not much is being done. And you know, we try to know, it's very difficult to know how quickly your patients are going to have seizures. So you need to work very closely with the neurologist. Sometimes you want to cut down some of their medications even prior to surgery. You really want to optimize. You generally want to get about 3 seizures. Now, if they're a stereotype and they all look the same, that's all you need. But if you get 3 seizures and each one looks different, you may need more seizures to try to quantify, you know, how many seizures look, you know, which way. You also don't want to get clusters of seizures. So 3 seizures in a row is not helpful. You do want them to be spontaneous. You want them to be their habitual seizures, and you want them to be spaced out. You could consider a medication wean as an alternative. If the EEG looks pretty bland after day 1 or 2, you may consider a wean, but you don't want to generally do this right away. So with subdural grid evaluations, on Friday, when we go back to remove the electrodes, I like to do the definitive procedure at that time, because you already have a craniotomy, whether it's a resection or placing RNS, you can do that at the same time. But with stereo EEG, we try to delay that next stage. First of all, because you don't have to do a craniotomy to remove it. You just remove the electrodes at the bedside. And also you want to try to space out the procedure to lower your infection risk. So indications for subdural grids, if you have a cortically based lesion with an ill-defined epileptogenic area, again, you need to have a reasonable hypothesis. And also you want to make sure that you can't obtain your information through an awake craniotomy. There's definitely limitations on the pediatric side or how young you can go. There's been groups that have done awake craniotomies in children, can be done, but you really need a very cooperative child to do that on. And again, keep in mind, you can map the brain in this region, in this fashion, but you cannot delineate your, you cannot map seizure onset in an awake patient. So that if you need to know where your seizure onset's coming from, then you want to do an extra operative ECOG, meaning you implant the electrodes. These are what these grids look like. They're very soft. They conform to the brain. This is an 8x8 grid, which is one of the most common ones that we use. This is a strip we use very common. And these are interhemispheric grids. So these can be slid down the midline if you want to cover those regions. Here's an article showing feasibility of awake craniotomy in pediatric population. In this group, it was mostly done for tumors, but also for epilepsy. And again, there are potentially some serious complications that can occur. But again, in OE, well-selected patients, especially at a center that has experience doing awake craniotomies in children, should be able to do this as well. So in terms of the subdural evaluation, so one of the most important things, I spent a lot of time before the case with folks like Dr. Solomon, Andy Frew, Patty Walshaw, creating the case. You really want to import all the imaging modalities that you have done and build that case into BrainLab. BrainLab or whatever neuronavigation software you're using is going to be critical, because if you do a craniotomy and stare at the brain, you're not going to know what to do next, right? That there's really no clue as to where the abnormality is if you don't have those imaging modalities fused. You really want to do a wide craniotomy and large brain exposure. This is not, you don't do epilepsy surgery through a supraorbital incision or eyebrow cut or anything like that. You really want to have good exposure of the brain, because you're kind of going to be limited to what you can record if you don't expose the brain. So this is usually here in trauma, you kind of see this much exposure of the brain. You want to place your grid directly on the surface of the brain. You want to customize the edges of your grid. You want to make sure there's no sharp edges pointing to the onto the cortex. Very important to look at the veins and make sure you don't have any venous compression or venous hypertension. You want to secure the tails of your electrodes to the dura. I've seen one case in residency on camera where it's an adult patient in Toronto that pulled out their subdural grid during a seizure, a hypermotor seizure. So you don't want that to happen. I always do an expansile duroplasty. You don't want to close the dura on a, especially in a young child that has a very full brain. You place an electrode. You don't want to bring those dural edges together without an expansile duroplasty. The bone flap is free floating, so allows room for pushing the bone flap out if there's any swelling. And lots of central tachyp sutures, long tunneling of the electrodes to minimize the risk of infection. I place these patients on IV antibiotics for 72 hours and IV steroids for 72 hours, again, to decrease some of the swelling, and always send cultures at the time of electrode removal in case you have a delayed infection. You really want to understand the venous anatomy, make sure especially your larger venous structures, again, make sure there's no compression on them. So all the patients that get a subdural grid, at least on the pediatric side, they spend the entire time in the ICU. They need Q1-hour nursing, vital checks. You really want to make sure there's no mass effect from the electrodes and hematoma formation. We had one patient since I've been here last 7 years that developed a very delayed hematoma under the subdural grid. Actually was asymptomatic, but the way we knew there was a problem was that the EEG signals became, we started to lose the amplitude. So we got a CT scan, this is what it looked like, and we had already obtained all our information at that stage, so we actually took the patient to surgery. This is the large subdural that was underneath the grid, evacuated, and actually we ended up doing the resection at the same time at 3 a.m. But so these things can happen. These are not inconsequential. CSF leak, you got to monitor for that. I don't routinely change head wraps. I know some surgeons like to change it on day whatever, 2 or 5 or 7. You generally, if you do a good job closing, you really don't want to mess with the head wrap at all, right? Because if you're taking scissors next to the head of a patient with epilepsy and grids and electrodes and wires coming out of their head, you have a high chance of cutting one of those electrodes, which means we've got to go back to the operating room. And then obviously monitor for infection. And sometimes these patients can go into status, especially as you're weaning their medication. So one of the other things I commonly do is I place a PICC line for these patients during the hospitalization. Because if you're weaning their medication, sometimes you're doing brain mapping where you're stimulating the brain. And if these patients have prolonged seizures, sometimes they can lose their peripheral IVs. So you want to have a reliable way to stop their seizures if you need to. So I always place a PICC line on the Monday where we implant these electrodes, and then we take it out Friday when they're ready to go home. So this is a systematic review meta-analysis that was done on subdural grids, 21 studies, 7.1% risk of infection, 4% risk of intracranial hemorrhage, 2.4% risk of increased ICP, and 3% rate of unanticipated surgery. I think these numbers are a little bit on the high side, but it does tell you that there's a whole host of complications that can occur with subdural grids, and it's not inconsequential. But this is the type of information that you really get, and this is what patients and families love, where you, this is a cartoon of their brain with the grids showing you exactly where the spikes are, area of slowing, seizure onset is these red circles. Fast ripple is a biomarker. It's considered a HFO that we talked about earlier. In this region, you can see the HFO co-localized nicely with the seizure onset zone, but you can also see them in places further away. But really, you get this type of information. You get your neuropsychologist for us, Dr. Walsh, will come by and do brain mapping where we are stimulating different electrodes, getting the patient to do different things. And I encourage actually all the residents at some point in residency to sit on at least one of these sessions where they do brain mapping. I think it's important to see that and how that's done. Usually that's done with the neurologist in the room as well, because you look for things like after discharges, patient goes into a seizure, you want to be able to stop that seizure during that period. But we get this sort of map. We try to figure out where the central sulcus is. And then we draw out exactly the boundaries of our resection. So for here, you want to remove the right frontal lobe, anterior to the motor area. And then your job as an epilepsy surgeon is to execute that plan. And that's what you get. So this is a specific case example. This is a 20-year-old male, had a previous resection in the postcentral gyrus. Pathology was chronic meningoencephalitis, but he really had very focal seizures of his left hand. He had clonic movements of his left hand, and that really prevented him from driving. That was the most important thing for him. And for a patient like this with Rolandic epilepsy, so motor sensory region, really the best study is a grid evaluation. So here, because it was a redo, it's hard to get great exposure with a redo without having to dissect, you know, an adherent dura from the brain. We did a smaller opening, but placed a grid in a very focal area. This is the central sulcus in blue. This is anterior, this is posterior. And you can see very nicely here that electrode 14 is exactly where the seizures start, and they stay in that electrode for a very, very, very long time. So in this particular case, we were able to do a very, very focal, small resection right there. And this patient has been seizure-free, and we also mapped out the hand function and ensured there was no movement right there. So there was no function right there. So we're able to do that, and this patient's able to drive and has been seizure-free for a long time. So this, for this scenario, subdural grid evaluation is the better modality. I'm going to transition and talk about stereo electroencephalography, stereo EEG. This is a methodology that was introduced by the French, and it refers to an anatomical, electrical, and clinical methodology aimed to verify the presurgical hypothesis on location extent of the epileptogenic area. So you really need to consider all three. And you need to really have a good understanding of, again, semiology and sort of how that seizure is originating and spreading through the brain to be able to determine where to place your electrodes. The strengths of EEG is that it's thought of as being less invasive, but my particular feeling about that is, again, you guys are all neurosurgeons, you know that just because something is less invasive doesn't mean it's less dangerous. When you're putting electrode deep in the brain, insular lesion region, or you know, the hypothalamus or those areas, there's nothing minimally invasive about that. The cut on the scalp is small, but you can get some really bad complications from it. But it does allow you to record from deep and buried cortical structures. It allows you to get better temporal spatial understanding of epileptic activity. And sometimes the electrodes can also be used to stimulate in order to localize eloquent cortex as well as to elicit seizures. You can do that with subdural grid mapping as well. So these are stimulation-induced seizures that some people like to do. It's controversial. There's some papers saying that if you stimulate and cause a seizure in an area at a very low threshold, that may be your epileptogenic area. But more classic way is you kind of want spontaneous habitual seizures, not stimulation-induced. So you're going to hear these words a lot, SEEG, we're doing depth. To you, it may all mean the same thing, or, you know, how do you tell one apart, right? Some people like to call it SEEG, some people like to call it depth, and some people get pretty angry if you call one, you know, call it by the wrong name. So I'll fill you in on that a little bit. So the electrodes are actually different. So SEEG electrodes are smaller in diameter, higher resolution. Look at all the area of contact compared to the depth electrode. Usually the tip can also record, but there is no internal stylet. So these are, when you place these electrodes, you got to place a stylet before it, create a path, and then place these. What you're seeing that we're using here is we're using depth electrodes, right? So this is, I don't think Dr. Fried uses SEEG electrodes. He uses depth electrodes. I also use depth electrodes, but in a SEEG methodology. I'll show you that, what I mean by that. But these depth electrodes are larger in diameter, lower resolution, and commonly don't have an electrode right at the tip, but there is an internal stylet. So these do have their own, they can create their own trajectory. So when we say depth evaluation versus SEEG evaluation, what do we mean? So they both actually originated from Benko and Tellerac in France. The depth evaluation is an orthogonal approach. right? So all these electrodes are placed orthogonally, perpendicular. And it was popularized in the United States and actually particularly the Mayo Clinic. Its main purpose is to lateralize the epilepsy, particularly the temporal lobes. So it's helpful in telling you, is it the left or right temporal lobe, and whether it's mesial or lateral onset. These electrodes are usually placed in a very symmetric fashion. You get the same number on the left and right. And again, you want to do that just to make sure that you're not biasing yourself towards one side or another, so you can really figure out which temporal lobe. The SEEG evaluation is you use various trajectories. They don't have to be orthogonal. And that's why I'll talk to you a little bit about a robot and why the robot makes it so much easier to do SEEG evaluations. It was popularized by the French and Italians. They've been doing this for a very long time, but recently in North America, a lot of folks have switched over to doing this. And to us, it's very novel. But when we go to these conferences, the French kind of look at us and, you know, we've been doing this for 30, 40 years. You know, this is nothing new. So the purpose of this, you can really target all neocortical locations. And generally, your implantations are more unilateral and asymmetric. It lends itself nicely for pediatric epilepsy, because as you know, in pediatric epilepsy, we're not usually dealing with temporal lobe epilepsy or, you know, mesial temporal lobe epilepsy. It's usually a neocortical based epilepsy. So that's what we mean with the SEEG versus depth evaluation. Now, there's a gray area. There's a lot of folks that sometimes will do a depth evaluation, but then put in certain other electrodes or make that asymmetric. So there's definitely a gray area as well. But this is the classic definition of when we talk about an SEEG versus depth evaluation. So functional mapping and SEEG can be done. You can get pretty reliable motor, sensory, and visual recordings. They have the possibility of subcortical mapping. Speech is also possible to map with SEEG electrodes, but it's a lot less reliable, and you really need to put a high density amount of electrodes in the speech area to be able to stimulate from electrode to electrode. So in general, if you're thinking that your seizure onset zone is close to the speech area, you're usually better off with a grid evaluation, or if you can, awake intraoperative mapping of the speech area. So limitations of stereo EEG is that you really get tunnel vision, right? So again, if you don't have a good implantation hypothesis, you're likely not to get a result that you can sort of act on. It is more appetizing to do stereo EEG or depth evaluations in patients that may not have a lesion, because it's not considered a major, or it's a more minimally invasive operation. So you are seeing, especially for non-lesional cases, that a lot of folks would say, let's not do a huge craniotomy in a grid. Let's just put the electrodes in, because it sort of, the complication profile is seen to be lower. You know, and I'll just quickly tell you, in the past, when we didn't have RNS and we were implanting subdural grids, I remember it's a very difficult decision, because sometimes I remember this one case in residency at SickKids. It was a 14-year-old boy who had a Rolandic epilepsy, and we implanted a grid, took a couple weeks to record the seizures, but it was coming exactly from his dominant hand. And he was a hockey player. He was a goalkeeper, actually. So we were in situations where, for example, we would offer a resection in that area, and he wouldn't want that because hockey was very important to him. And we didn't have RNS. So really, some of those patients would have to just explant the grid and then do nothing. So that was a very difficult thing to do. You basically operated twice on a patient with no therapeutic value. Nowadays, a little bit easier, again, with RNS, and we have other things to offer. Back in the day, we were doing MSTs. Some of you may have heard of this. This is multiple subpeel transections, really fallen out of favor. It's quite traumatic to the brain. There were some patients that woke up in status, but really the idea was for eloquent cortex epilepsy, you could, if you vertically make these vertical cuts, you can stop the spread of seizures, at least in a palliative way. You're not going to get seizure freedom, but lower the seizure frequency, but preserve function in that area. And we're also seeing it now, MSTs being performed in dominant hippocampi. So there's folks that are going in in situations where you cannot remove a dominant hippocampus, you do MSTs of the hippocampus. Again, this is being done mostly outside the United States, that they don't have access to the RNS. But that's one technique that we were doing mostly in the past. In terms of SEEG and its complications, this is a large meta-analysis. A lot of these SEEG studies, they're going to count the number of electrodes. They're going to say 22,000 electrodes with their complication rate is per electrode. But you got to be careful, because if you're putting 20 electrodes in a patient, patients don't count their complications by each electrode. They get a bleed from any of those 20 electrodes. That's a bleed. That's a stroke. So you got to kind of look at how these studies are being reported. But essentially, the surgical risk of morbidity is low and the risk of permanent neurological deficit is low. This can happen. If you do enough of these cases, at some point, you're going to get an intraparenchymal hemorrhage or large stroke. There's patients that can die from this as well. Subdural hematomas and epidural hematomas are a little bit less common than intraparenchymal hematomas. Now, I will say the majority of hematomas you get are tract hematomas that the brain will absorb over time. There's usually nothing to do, but you will get this every once in a while. So it's important to be aware of it and also make sure that you really need to do this extra step. There's been plenty of cases, there's a epilepsy surgery techniques meeting where it's a global consortium of surgeons, and we discuss cases. And sometimes there are patients that really didn't need a phase two evaluation, and you get something like this. So it's really important to make sure that you require this extra step. So in terms of SEEG planning, you want to look at the anatomy, semiology, and EEG to determine where you want your electrodes. You want to get a volume metric MRI. This is a 3T Tesla scan with thin cuts. In terms of blood vessel imaging, in the past, you would get a DSA, but nowadays CT and MRI are so good that you can just get CT with and without contrast or MRI with and without GAD and use that to avoid your electrodes. I will say if you have a vascular lesion or AVM or something that's causes more abnormality in the blood vessels, you probably still want to get an angiogram over CT or MRI. In terms of trajectory planning, you want to maximize the contacts over the gray matter, the neocortical contacts. It's not very helpful to have the majority of electrodes just sitting in white matter. You want to avoid the ventricle CSF spaces and intraoperative CSF leak. If you start getting a CSF leak, all your trajectories will be off. You want to avoid the sulci, be at least 2 millimeters away from the blood vessels, especially the pial surface blood vessels, because those are the blood vessels that are stuck between the skull and the brain, and they're not going to move. The ones that are deeper inside the brain are usually a little bit more mobile. You want to avoid thin areas of the bone, particularly the squamous temporal region in young children. You want to be as perpendicular to the skull as possible. You also want to make sure that the electrodes, they have some logical plan. You don't want to implant, crisscrossing electrodes with different trajectories and then have the neurologist figure out where the seizures are coming from. It gets very, very challenging and difficult to interpret that EEG. And you also want to minimize the number of electrodes. If you can place one electrode that can record from two areas of interest, that's beneficial. And also there's been a lot of studies that once you get to a certain number, I think it's 14 or above electrodes, you really don't have a good hypothesis and those patients aren't going to do well. So you really want to make sure that you're minimizing the number of electrodes. This is what a typical SEEG plan may look like. And again, this is done well in advance. So for those that are interested in epilepsy, I would definitely encourage you to try to come to the CMP conference. And then, you can email me or Dr. Fried, Dr. Bari. And when we plan our electrodes, you want to be there at that meeting as well. It's much more beneficial for you than, just doing the operative steps. So in terms of SEEG placement, patients are placed under general anesthesia. I keep them all paralyzed, so there's no movement. A frame is placed. We get some intraoperative CT scan for co-registration. You want to put your electrodes in a logical sequence. So in general, anterior to posterior and superior to inferior. The reason why is if you get a CSF leak from the back of the brain, the whole brain anteriorly, it will sag down. So all your trajectories will be off. And you also want to put your deeper electrodes first, because those are most important in terms of, you know, so your insular electrodes or your thalamic electrodes, if you're going to do that. You want to obtain your trajectory, pin, stab, incision. Again, we use the arc. Most places use a robot, small drill. You place your bolt, and your bolt is what's going to give you the trajectory. So that's the most important part in terms of your trajectory. And you measure the depth, and you I use BrainLab on top of all this as a double check system. You want to pierce the dura, place the lead to the target, tighten the cap to prevent a CSF leak. And at the end, you want to obtain a CT or MRI for co-localization. This is generally what it looks like. And when you go back to do a craniotomy, and these are the stereo EEG holes in the skull that you can see. And this is what it looks like as it pierces the brain. So in terms of the SEEG workflow, we place our electrodes. Again, I also do this on a Monday, Friday. I place the electrodes on a Monday. Patient goes to the EMU. Again, I try to keep all our patients on the ICU side. But if you have a good step-down unit, they can probably be in the step-down as well. We don't have an EMU on the pediatric side, so everything's mostly done in the ICU. Localize where the electrodes are, do the EEG. Surgery two is to remove the electrodes, and then in a delayed fashion, we would go back to do either a resection, RNS, lit, so on. In infants, you can place electrodes without bolts. So you can do boltless SEEG implants. You would basically suture the electrode right to the scalp. You know, sometimes the bone is really thin. So for example, in this area, you probably can't get a bolt in there. It's a little bit less accurate than having the bolt in there, but allows you to do SEEG in very young children. The newer thing we're doing now, as we're doing a lot of thalamic stimulation for epilepsy, is we have been, during our SEEG evaluation, I have been implanting the anterior nucleus and centromedian nucleus of the thalamus at the same time of these SEEG evaluations. The reason why is if they're not a good candidate for a localized resection or therapy, I actually can obtain information as to what the best target is for their epilepsy stimulation, if we're going to go for a target in the thalamus. So this is being, I think there's very few groups doing this. I think there's an adult series that was published, but it allows you, we can nowadays do this as well. The insula is a very interesting area and ignored for many years, but in recent years, I see a lot of talk about insula, whether it's for glioma or epilepsy. There's a renewed interest, I must say, and actually probably a common cause of failed temporal lobe epilepsy surgery is that insular origin. And obviously, because it's deep from the surface of the brain, it's a little bit harder to localize, and your surface EEG electrodes aren't going to be able to give you direct recordings from the insula. But there's many ways to implant the insula. There's an orthogonal approach through the pia. You can just push the electrode through the pia across to the other side, that some people like to do, especially if they're doing orthogonal approaches. You can split the Sylvian fissure and go trans orthogonal that way. You can do an SEEG approach from a parietal trajectory or a frontal trajectory, or you can split the Sylvian fissure and put electrodes from the apex, so from the Lyman insula up backward. So there's many different ways to sample the insula. This is a quick case of an SEEG, 3-year-old right-hand dominant female who had developmental regrade catastrophic epilepsy, infantile spasms, and had on MRI polymicrogyri on the right side, but also by lateral paraventricular heterotopias, FDG PET showed decreased metabolism on the right side. So we didn't really know if this patient required a full hemispherectomy or we could do a localized resection. So we implanted invasive SEEG electrodes. Here you can see predominantly on the right side, very little on the left. And again, it takes us a long time to do these just using a frame. If you have a robot, you can do this in a couple hours. This is what our depth electrode, SEEG electrode, not depth, electrode placement looks like. And we identified seizures coming from both the frontal lobe and the insula. And there's really the only way to address both these regions, especially in the kid who has neuroplasticity, is to do a hemispherectomy, because you're not going to be able to resect insula, frontal lobe, And it's probably not, you know, it's probably this whole region. So we did a peri-insular hemispherotomy here, and patient recovered quite well. No isolated finger movements, but the strength mostly all came back. And then most importantly, in terms of cognition development, the child really started doing well. This is a good summary slide that was put together. Basically, the strengths, limitations, and indications of ECOG versus subdural recordings versus SEEG. And again, I'm happy to share this with you to sort of, it helps sort of conceptualize and put this into a good framework for your understanding to determine why we use which modality. Again, this is something I put together. So in situations favoring subdural grid is where your epileptogenic area is more focal, whereas closer to eloquent areas where you want to map function. It's not very good for paralimbic and limbic structures, very difficult to with grid evaluations. If your imaging shows a superficial lesion, this is helpful. In first-time cases, it's helpful. It's very difficult to, especially for a big exposure, to dissect the dura away from the brain in a redo situation. Children and infants with thin skull subdural grids are easier to do, and it's a simpler surgical. I don't know what I mean by that last comment, but favoring SEEG if you have less focal epileptogenic area. So if you want to sample, let's say, frontal lobe and occipital lobe, and then the other side, you can't do that with a grid, or it's much more challenging to do with a grid. If you're looking at non-eloquent areas, this is better. It's definitely better for limbic and paralimbic structures. If you don't have a lesion or you have a very deep lesion, this is the way to go. In reoperation cases, SEEGs are easier to do because you don't have to dissect the dura away. And children, infants with thin skull, I say no, but again, this is, we're pushing the limits of what can be done. There are many groups. This is a group in London, Ontario, which is, a very, it's an epilepsy group with a rich history. And you can see over time, their subdural electrode evaluations and SEEG, it's almost 90, 95% SEEG now. And you kind of, this is the trend at many hospitals now, also in the United States. And this is a systematic review comparing subdural grids to SEEGs. The writing's small there, but essentially what it tells you is that the risks are both low for both of them, and they're very comparable. There's not a big difference. So if you know how to do each one of these well, that shouldn't really make the difference. This is an easier to read slide, again, comparing SEEG with subdural grid evaluations. With the subdural grid, you can see the epileptogenic zone was located more often and resection was done more often. But in terms of the ones that got resection, the seizure freedom rates were the same. Now, any study comparing SEEG to subdural grid is really comparing apples to oranges. It's not the same patient population. And these two evaluation techniques are largely complementary. So what SEEG is not good at, subdural grids are good at, and vice versa. And quite often, to be honest with you, nowadays we're doing a lot of hybrid evaluations. So this is a patient where we exposed, first put intrahemispheric grids. This is what they look like. Then placed depth electrodes. This is a Rolandic epilepsy. So this is motor sensory area. And then on top of that, we place a grid. And this is what we get. So we get recordings from intrahemispheric region. We get depth electrode recordings and surface, and really allows us to evaluate this patient in 3D. The only thing with a craniotomy when you and placing depth electrodes is that you're going to be a little bit less accurate. The moment you open the head and open the dura, there's going to be a little bit of brain shift. So you're going to lose a little bit of accuracy. So in conclusion, phase two evaluations often required in epilepsy surgery. Both techniques have relative advantages and disadvantages. And really, your surgical epilepsy team needs to pick the right approach for the right patient. And as an epilepsy surgeon, you need to be comfortable with both techniques. Thank you.
SEEG electrode and not the depth in the second case.
Which one?
Right frontal and thalamic.
This one.
Why do we use SEG? Oh, because this is so we're dealing here with we're pretty confident that the seizure is coming from the right side. Hypometabolism on the right, you can see that here. The polymicrogyri is the right frontal lobe, it's kind of small, hard to see there. And infantile spasms, so they're generalized looking epilepsy, but they can be coming from focal lesions. So just because they're infantile spasms, they don't necessarily mean they're coming from the whole brain. Could be coming from a lesion. So we were pretty confident we had good laterality in the right side. So an SEG type evaluation, meaning it's asymmetric, more to the right. And also we're not going in, you know, it's not a bitemporal. So we would call that an SEG. And the electrode, if you look at the, these look more orthogonal, but this one, for example, is going more parasagittal. So they're not all in this orthogonal plane. So I call this SEG evaluation. Is that your question?
No, but the electrodes themselves are SEG electrodes. You said you typically use depths, right?
Yeah, the reason I use depths is because we can put the Vanke-Free research electrodes in there. So
those are depth electrodes, but you're using it like an SEG.
Yes.
Oh, it just looked like they had so many contacts.
Yeah, some of them are long, but yeah,
they're all like the depth style electrodes.
Yeah, I'm using depth electrodes in an SEG.
I've read before that epilepsy is cortex, and I've always wondered if that's because, you know, we do EEG and it's on the surface, right? And perceptual. But my question is, with depth electrodes, you find like subcortical origin zones?
Generally not. Generally, it's neocortical. It's on the surface, but again, depending on what for example, FCD type 2, usually have a transmantle sign. You can have dysplastic neurons all the way from the subpinimal zone all the way to the surface.
I guess you never find like a gray matter epilepsy.
That's a great question. So we are actually looking at, because now we have a decent series of thalamic SEG. And actually, I don't know if you can hear me. Let me turn this off.
So now we have a decent number of thalamic EEGs, SEEG. And I can tell you from the 13 or so patients we've studied, the thalamus is almost always simultaneous onset with the seizures or near simultaneous. From those patients, we haven't seen a lead from the thalamus that spreads to the cortex. But it's one of those fascinating areas. There's people looking into that. Especially now as we're doing more and more thalamic type recordings. The idea is certainly for certain seizure types and primary generalized epilepsy, whether there's a central pacemaker that's causing on, whether that's the thalamus. There's some papers on there. I will tell you though, and this is indirect and anecdotal, but Dr. Mathern told me he had at least a couple hemispherectomy patients that failed hemispherectomy, and all he did is he went back and he resected thalamus and they became seizure free. It's unpublished, but for what it's worth, that could be an example. Maybe there was dysplastic neurons there, but there's nothing written about it. Yes.
All right. Great talk.
Yeah.
Cross-lesional surgeons.
Yeah.
When does patients present with seizures? When does a lesional patient become an epilepsy patient versus an oncologic or even a neurovascular, you know, cab mal or something like that? Is it the chronicity of the seizures? Is it the, you know, sometimes it's who do I refer this patient to? Let's say if they come in with a cab mal, I refer them to the neurovascular surgeon or the epilepsy surgeon when they have seizures?
Yeah, great question. So I will say, what I see is the failures of tumor resection in a patient that still has epilepsy. And granted, I'm not seeing you know, the denominator, right? So, but I will say for lesional epilepsy, commonly related to a focal, a low-grade tumor or a cavernous malformation, those patients do really well to just a full resection of the lesion. If you get a gross total resection, that patient will likely do very well. And I, if you talk to epilepsy folks, they'll say, you know, they need an epilepsy evaluation, all that. But especially if it's seizures, they haven't failed more than two. It's just they've had a couple seizures and here's a lesion. Those patients will do really well. And I think for the vast majority of places, they don't require all this invasive, or not invasive, all this evaluation. Same for a cav mal that has presented with a seizure or two seizures and maybe just on one monotherapy. It's really the patients that have had epilepsy for a very long time and probably failed more than two medications. Sometimes those patients may have kindling, they may have dual pathology now, especially if it's a temporal lobe cav mal. Now they have hippocampal sclerosis on top of it. Those are patients that would sort of benefit from a epilepsy evaluation. So I'd look at the chronicity, maybe the numbers, how severe the seizure burden is. Because, you know, the patient populations that we operate on are kind of different. The tumor patients have had, you know, a seizure in the last year or a seizure in the last couple of months. Our patients have seizures every day. It's a very different patient population. But yeah, you know, there's enough data out there that, you know, if you just fully resect the region and for cav mals, you get the hemosiderin ring and you can do that all safely, I think those patients will do really well.
The critical thing is really the history. You know, if it's a patient, and in the adult population, we see patients who have had seizures for many years. And this kind of situation, you know, just resection of the lesion will not be sufficient. And also, especially if there is proximity to the hippocampus, you know, there's really a tendency for the hippocampus to become excitable on its own merit. So this kind of patient really needs epilepsy evaluation. But the patient who present with one or two seizures first time, you know, probably a gross resection of the lesion is sufficient.
Dr. Filo, I have one question from you. You mentioned that in some centers, they use WIC craniotomy in children. How do they call the child? Do they bring the parents to be with them during the surgery? Because it's very, very difficult to call the child to do the WIC, even the adult. Not everybody wants to know what's going on. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so these are, when I say child, they're sort of, the youngest is sort of probably around 10 or 12 years of age, and they have to be evaluated by a psychologist to make sure that they're mature enough and they can handle it. Now, there's always a fallback plan. So if the patient is not cooperative or is having issues, you know, we can always intubate, we can always place the grid. But you're right. I mean, it's sort of, you know, I'll say it can be done. But in practice, and you know, thinking about the issues that you presented, and also it adds a lot of OR time. And quite often, a lot of times, even if the seizures are coming that close to the language areas in a child, I'd probably want to map it and do that in an extraoperative setting. And do, you know, so sometimes things that just because we can do it doesn't mean we should. So it's an option.
They use FDG only for the seizure, but there are dopaminergic studies that they do in the adult. I don't know in the children. They send them to Wayne University, unfortunately, because they don't have the isotope here. In the past, that was the routine. Do they use other receptors for checking on the children, or only the FDG is used for physiologic studies?
Yeah, so... So in terms of for epilepsy, we're typically using FDG. There's groups that use AMT for TSC, but those are the only two isotopes. I don't know, maybe Dr. Fried or someone can weigh in as well. I don't know if there's any other isotopes being used for the epilepsy world.
A couple of patients that, you know, would have multiple seizures a day, and then while they're being observed, have none. And the first couple of days you have an anesthesia effect, but it's like a week after and they're still not having, despite like taking off their meds. Like, how common is that and why is that?
Yeah, I think like you mentioned, one of it is prolonged anesthesia time. I mean, we're, our patients are 10, 12 hours under anesthesia. Again, just because we don't have a robot, because if you do have one, you can plan everything ahead of time and you don't have to change your trajectories on the fly, especially with your SEEG electrode. When you use a Lexel frame and you're doing all these different trajectories, quite often you're going to have collisions and you can't use our trajectories. You got to plan it a lot of times while the patient's asleep. But to your point, sometimes we're putting thalamic electrodes. I've seen that slow down seizures, at least temporarily. There's a lesional effect. And just, yeah, just the effect of general anesthesia could be quite a lot. You know, keep in mind, the younger the kids are, the more fat their body has. And that's where the anesthesia gets stored. So it can take a few days to just exit their system. But yeah, it's a good point. You want to really minimize the number of days patients in hospital with these electrodes. Yes, Milan.
It's kind of institution dependent, but what's your thoughts on MAG as part? Where does that come into as part of the modality of the company's patient?
Yeah, so Toronto, we had a lot of experience with MAG. We're trying to get a MAG. I think it's helpful. If we had it, we'd probably use it on every patient. It's the type of thing. So if you have, depending on how deep the focus is, may or may not be helpful. What you're looking at with MEG is you want to find a cluster. So if you have a cluster of dipoles, there's studies showing that clusterectomies or that can be helpful. Because we don't have it, we send our patients to San Francisco to get those evaluations, but we do it on an as-needed basis. So if there's enough of the phase one data is non-conclusive or it's divergent or giving us, and we kind of need the MEG as sort of a tiebreaker, those are situations where it could be helpful. And sometimes it could be, sometimes these patients are going to have a phase two anyway, but the MEG may be helpful in determining where exactly to place the electrodes. So if we had it, we would use it, but we just don't.
Navigation as well.
Yeah, you can definitely create objects. You can merge the MEG dipoles directly onto your navigation. But I will say there's not a lot of data with single dipoles. So you don't want to treat it as a, you know, unless you see a cluster, that's sort of when it's useful. And quite often we don't see a cluster.
Yes.
You said psychiatric illness is a contraindication to phase two. Is that because of, like, what you mean by that is inability to emotionally tolerate the leads?
Yeah.
So it seems like there's a certain amount of coincidence of psychiatric disease and epilepsy. And in some cases, like Friday has a paper in the last year or two showing phase two for depression, right, for psychiatric disease. So I guess my question is why is psychiatric disease a contraindication?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I'll answer it two different ways. There's quite a lot of data with patients that are depressed and have epilepsy. If you get rid of their seizures, they're at risk for suicide for some of them. Because you got to think about it. These patients have had a chronic debilitating illness. They've had a lot of attention because of this illness. And all of a sudden you take this away. And sometimes it also empowers, they have more energy to carry out what they wanted to. So if someone's, you know, suicidal ideations or anything like that. So we got to, you got to look at that because that those patients are at increased risk of suicide. You also, just because they have psychiatric disease doesn't make them not a candidate. So you do want to work very closely with a psychologist or psychiatrist prior to surgery to make sure they're emotionally ready. It's a very difficult stage of their treatment to be in hospital with these electrodes in. So again, you need a lot of cooperation with them. Again, we don't have a ton of experience on the pediatric side. It's more an adult phenomenon. Our kids usually don't have psychiatric disease, but yeah, it's more just emotionally being able to tolerate it. And also if they've had prior suicidal ideations or major depression, that's something you want to counsel on them on prior to just even undergoing this evaluation.
Yeah, just in the adult population, it's not an absolute. In the adult population, it's not an absolute contraindication. In fact, you know, many of the patients that we operate on, and including depth electrodes, you know, may be on antidepressants. So, but it's the main thing is having some psychiatry follow up that can you know accompany them in the process.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, everyone.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your questions or comments to ausman@snidigital.org. From UCLA Neurosurgery and supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and the Waymaster Corporation, producers of the leading Gen television series, Silent Majority Speaks, Role Models, and Medical News Network. Thank you.